what services?
Because this conversation is so important, we've decided to forego our break and continue so that this audience, as well as our online audience, can get the full depth and breadth of this conversation. Sir, you were at the microphone. Did you have a question? Are you short? Okay. Ma'am, please go right ahead.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for addressing this problem. How do we educate law enforcement agencies concerning mental health issues in our communities? I'm concerned because 55% of our black males are incarcerated and they should be receiving treatment in hospitals. So how do we address law enforcement agencies to make them aware of this problem within our communities?
And I want to piggyback on that. You do not have to go far into any news cycle to see that this is an issue, not only with black men, but in the community at large, where officers need to be aware. They need to be trained. We've seen, unfortunately, incidences in Washington, D.C. There was an incident earlier this year in Seattle where officers shot and killed a woman who was wielding a knife, but she had mental health challenges. I want all of you to at least begin to share with us your thoughts about dealing with the police and those that are dealing with mental illness. Dr. Nemo, can you please start?
We just need to establish partnerships with, you know, MPD or Maryland Police and Virginia to teach them how, you know, what mental health looks like. You know, if this person has this behavior, it's not drugs, it's this. And other states are doing that. They're training their police officers to be more familiar with mental health clients.
Do you think it would be beneficial if we could invite law enforcement agencies to forums like this?
Oh, definitely. You know, we have a relationship with MPD, so we have a lot of sexual assault and domestic violence. So now we have a Howard University and Interpersonal Violence Prevention Program has a relationship with them, because in the past it's been an issue of how they interview our victims of sexual assault. So that's changed now. So now we have a partnership with them. So that's easy.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Hurt, please. I'd like to hear from you and also Dr. Brooks Davis.
So similar to what Dr. Nemo mentioned, I think partnerships are extremely important. I have a number of colleagues in other states that are establishing evidence-based trainings for police officers to educate them on how to intervene when they're addressing a mental health crisis, and also to give them support around some of the trauma they've experienced and how it affects the way they approach these situations. So certainly as these become more prevalent in other communities and we develop the research to support it, it is making a difference for the law enforcement officers, then I think it will begin to come up in different states and will be available nationwide.
Dr. Brooks Davis, if you want to add to that.
So just I would say briefly, in terms of advocacy, I would encourage the community to connect with your local police departments and also ask them, what are you doing with your police officers to encourage and know that they are culturally competent when they're on the streets working with the community? So it starts with us, of course, advocating, but I would also encourage you as the community to advocate as well. Sometimes they will listen to you more than they will listen to us because they think we're just trying to come in and get a check.
Not to mention the fact that I don't think that it would be overstating the fact that we also need to pay attention to the mental health and welfare of our first responders. Amen?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Because we need to know who is protecting and serving us as well. So we need to deal with that as well. Sir, if you have a question or a comment.
Hello, yes. I just wanted to mention or touch with you all. I have been a caregiver for the mental.
Get a little closer to the microphone, please, so we can hear you.
I just happened to catch this broadcast on the radio when I just woke up, and I actually rode my bicycle here because I just wanted to see the congregation.
We can't hear you, and I appreciate it. We're a little low on time. What's your question or comment? And we appreciate you listening.
My question is, there we go. How advanced have you all gotten to the protection of the clients? Because I have lost one of the patients from the mental health program, and I am associated with one, and I have another friend also that's part of the QCI. Are you familiar with QCI? She's part of the QCI program, and she's just left that program. Under what condition, I'm not exactly sure.
Now, when you say protection of the clients, in what way? What do you mean?
On many occasions, she was not able to, I wasn't able to withstand her. And then when the officers and the mental health people got there, they couldn't control her. So what are you all actually addressing when you all mentioned protection?
Dr. Hurd, your thoughts about that?
If I'm understanding you correctly, are you asking how we're trained or equipped to protect ourselves when we're intervening in a dangerous situation?
From my viewpoint, I can actually see that how you all work. But what I'm trying to say is beyond us is what I'm trying to say. Because a lot of times it's not us, it's them.
You're wanting to know, are you asking us as a person who provides care for someone who has a mental illness, how can the caregiver be protected? Or how can the person who has
The person, because a lot of times the caregiver can be on site when the officers get there and it's still no help.
So I guess in that situation, I'd have to defer that to the organization that has hired the caregivers and the training that they provide. But also it depends on what's happening with the person who has the mental illness and when the police officers arrive. So I think part of it goes back to educating the police officers. Other parts is educating the persons with a mental illness. But if their mental illness is active and they have an active psychosis, there's not much persons can do in that time.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your comments. Pastor, I would be remiss if we didn't dig a little bit deeper into one of the critical reasons as to why we're here. We need to talk about the faith piece because, as we know, clinicians are important as well as counselors, but we need to talk about what part faith plays in treatment and healing. Talk to me about that, please.
Well, I think it's so important that we create an atmosphere of hope in all situations because the narrative does not have to remain as it is. And so we need to allow people to understand that faith helps us to actually move through the crisis that we are facing or that we are dealing with, and that there's always the possibility, recognize the possibility that your narrative is just for the moment, but with Christ, with the Word, with faith, there's always the open door to healing and open door to a better you. And the church has to be able to engage persons to really grab hold of that and believe that and understand that they're not alone. They're not alone in this, and that, we are people of the Word. We are people of faith, and that we need to marry our humanity with the spiritual aspect as well. And in doing that, that will help us to move forward in terms of a path of healing. It's not immediate, but at least there is light at the end of the tunnel. Never give up on hope. Never give up on the possibility that tomorrow will make a difference. And that's the responsibility of hope, to foster a faith, to foster that kind of spirit within the individual.
Lisa Daughtry is back, and for those of you who may have coming to the sanctuary late. Lisa lost her son to suicide at the age of 18. And I, just as a personal note, Lisa is a friend not only of mine, but of WHU. Lisa came to my program within 2 weeks after the passing of her son. And she sat on my program and she talked about what her son meant and what she was going through. That kind of strength is really immeasurable. Lisa, talk to us about this faith piece and how it has helped you move through the loss of your son.
I will say this, that after my son's funeral, repass, I had a friend who advised me to seek a therapist, and I needed it because at times I was having anxiety attacks. With the therapist that I was going to visit, one thing she did advise me as far as having faith, and I reiterate that, Pastor. For me, constant prayer, knowing that, looking at it, I know some people who have dealt with it, some people will look at it and say, okay, it was my fault. I'm not mad at God, because sometimes people will, first thing it says, I'm mad at him from taking my child or taking my friend or my husband. I'm not mad at God. I know there's a purpose for me to be here, to be a voice for everyone. For me, I constantly pray. And when I have triggers, have remembrance of my son, I make a phone call to my therapist, just basically schedule appointment just to get in tune with myself.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Sir, very quickly, we're low on time. What's on your mind?
As a patient of mental health, I wanted to really take the...
And can you speak up just a little bit?
As a patient of mental health, all right, I have struggled with some of the larger issues beyond the stigma, such as the fact that in 2013, President Obama launched the BRAIN Initiative, the brain research through advancing and innovative neurotechnologies to begin to understand the mapping, because what is evident is that they really don't know how the brain works. And if they don't know how the brain works, then it's very difficult for me as a patient to understand the protocols and the treatment procedures on treating me for something that they don't understand completely well enough to really provide me with the treatment.
What would you like our panel to address? I only have about 3 minutes left.
My second concern is, we're talking about the symptoms. I have had to do research on understanding a psychology that is in contrast to the environment we live in, which is built on Western psychology, which is based on the normalization of behaviors of a particular culture. And when you step outside of that culture, by default, if you do not fit in the culture of the dominant society, by default, you're already abnormal. By default.
Pastor, can you quickly address that? Because I think he does make an important point about culture.
Wow, that's really a great question. Let me talk from personal experience. African Methodist Episcopal Church, to watch us on a Sunday morning, the way we worship, it's in the Eurocentric understanding, we would all be called pretty much.
Using that word.
I didn't say that.
I know they did.
I didn't say that, but you make a very valid point in terms of understanding the essence of who we are, our true selves from our origin. And it's so important that you are true to your own identity and true to your origin. As African persons of origin, we try to explain to the congregation that we are not operating outside of what people would call normalcy. It goes back to our slave roots, that when we dealt with irreconcilable issues, oppression and slavery, one of our ways of coping with that was to express freely, vocally, and physically our frustration, which was therapeutic.
Pastor, I'm really low on time, and forgive me for stopping you in the middle of that thought, but we need to get information out about the center. I have 30 seconds, Dr. Brooks Davis. Please, how do you connect with the center?
Contact the Restoration Center at reedrestoration.com or call 301-352-1768.
One more time, please.
reedrestoration.com or call us at 301-352-1768.
Thank you all so much. We really appreciate it. Thank you for being part of this important conversation. We need to keep talking about it. Thank you to all of our panelists and to Reed Temple AME, the pastor, of course, the First Lady, and the Reed Temple Restoration Center. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, September 13th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.